Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story, an epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 10. Even the greatest king can lose his way. The loss of Arsuf was another terrible blow for the once invincible Saladin. Richard's losses were comparatively minor, although we do know that one of the outstanding warriors of the Third Crusade, a highly esteemed French knight named James of Avennes, was dead. Reports coming that he was found surrounded by the bodies of the 15 Saracens he had taken with him in his last fight. Word was that he had lost an arm and a leg before he died. A truly heart-rending image from the next morning has come down through all the centuries, where weeping men, tougher than anything we can imagine, gently wiped the blood from James's familiar face and carried his savagely wounded corpse to its rest in Arsuf. Arsuf was Lionheart's. If Messina, Cyprus, and Acre hadn't already proved it, there now was no doubt that Richard was the greatest of all Western warriors, the invincible Crusader king who swept aside the best the Muslim world could hurl at him. His reputation among the Arabs was unrivaled. One wrote to Saladin, "Never have we seen anyone like him. No one can resist him." When the thrilling stories got back to Europe, Richard was idolized as Achilles, Charles Martel, and Alexander the Great rolled into one. It was taken for granted that he would soon be the savior of Jerusalem. Richard himself wrote to the abbot of Clairvaux, saying that he expected to be in the Holy City soon after Christmas. The defeated Saladin, reportedly so crushed by Arsuf that he couldn't eat, went south, first to Jaffa, then to the prized port of Ascalon with its 53 towers, burning both to the ground rather than having the fortified cities fall into Crusaders' hands. The destruction of Ascalon, a city prized for its beautiful trees, was a particular torment. The crucial hinge between Syria and Egypt, its massive defenses had to be blown up and torn apart foot by foot. He told his men, "By God, I would prefer to lose all my sons rather than demolish a single stone." But demolish them he did. Thousands of helpless, terrified civilians had to flee into the desert, with nothing but what they could carry. Their story was never recorded, of course, but a Second World War eyewitness to the flight of Italians from a bombed-out town probably serves to describe these earlier refugees.
"We came upon them in little clusters, trudging along the roadsides through a veil of sleet. They were clad in unidentifiable scraps of black, rain-soaked clothing, and many walked barefoot in coagulating mud that was barely above the freezing point. Shapeless bundles slung over their shoulders, they plodded by with downcast eyes, mute and expressionless. I think I had never seen more pitiable people.
As for Saladin, who had just been forced to cut his empire in two, he moved off to supervise the defenses that had to be mounted in Jerusalem against the almost inevitable Crusader siege, destroying small forts that had been painstakingly built by earlier Crusaders along the route, poisoning the wells outside the city. The Crusaders soon poured into Jaffa in their thousands. The town had been wrecked by Saladin, but it was a place where Richard's superb army could recover from its ordeal, round up strays from as far away as Acre, settle into the dull job of rebuilding local fortifications. Lionheart brought his wife and sister to Jaffa, and then, for his own amusement, went out scouting, hunting, and hawking, so carelessly confident that he was nearly captured in several skirmishes with Saracen scouts. One ended with four of his companions killed. Another expedition got him home safely only when one of his knights yelled that he rode with Melek Rik, Richard the Terrible, which brought the encircling Muslims down on his own head. Richard was beginning to seriously irritate his captains, who grudgingly admired his daring while snarling about his recklessness. The knight who saved him, William de Preux, spent the rest of the crusade in a Saracen prison and had to be ransomed by his family at considerable expense. Envoys swirled between the two camps. Richard demanded a permanent Outremer recognized by the Muslims, along with unchallenged perpetual control of Jerusalem and the return of the True Cross, which still had not made it back to European hands. Cairo, Egypt itself, should be given up as tribute. At one point, Richard even made the incredible proposal that Saladin's brother should marry Richard's widowed sister Joan, the couple becoming the new rulers of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. He remarked that this would work best if the brother, a devout Muslim from a famously devout family, would convert to Christianity, an idea not only rejected by Saladin's family, but also by Joan, a Plantagenet through and through, who was reportedly infuriated when she heard about it, absolutely refusing to marry what she called a heathen, even in the interests of world peace. Meanwhile, Conrad of Montferrat was sending his own peace envoys to Saladin while Jerusalem shimmered, untouched, over the hills to the east. The reality was that Richard and his crusade were now stuck. All of that spirited campaigning, the stuff of martial poetry, the seal on his reputation as the new Achilles, had left him 50 miles from Saracen-held Jerusalem, heavily fortified Jerusalem, a place Muslims would die for. He had lost men, and he had lost horses and supplies. Assuming he was still strong enough to take the city, he would be 50 miles from his supply base at the coast. 50 punishing miles through alien territory that was home to the Muslim defenders. Worst of all, regaining Jerusalem meant that most of his men would reasonably consider their vows fulfilled and head back to their former lives. After so much effort, the place would be left defended by nothing but local Christian militiamen and a few exceptionally devout crusaders, with Saladin poised to snatch it back. Richard truly didn't want the city. He wanted the only strategic objective that made any sense: Ascalon. The great port, once rebuilt, could be used as a tremendous wedge against Saladin, a stepping stone to the riches of Egypt, possibly to command of the world on a scale not seen since Alexander the Great. Yet men from all corners of Europe hadn't followed Richard through hell to take the ruins of Ascalon. To the common soldier freezing in his tent, the idea that his future would consist of rebuilding yet more walls, trying to fit rocks into place day after day, made no sense. Richard's own thinking wavered. He had quite recently written his letter to the abbot of Clairvaux, promising he'd soon be in Jerusalem. Indeed, he justified his massacre of the 2,000 or more Acre hostages with the excuse that he needed to head in that direction with all due speed, free of excess baggage, human or otherwise. A couple of weeks later, he sent an entirely different message to his fleet, that next summer he intended to hasten with all our forces into Egypt. Then, within a week of his letter about next summer in Egypt, he sought a meeting between both sides' envoys via a message to Saladin, which began with the gloomy assessment, "The Muslims and the Christians are both bleeding to death. The country is utterly ruined. The time has come to stop this." It sounded like he intended some intensive peace initiative, but his proposal for, quote, "stopping this," unquote, consisted of his renewed demand that all of the old kingdom of Jerusalem be restored to the west, that the true cross, still not returned, be sent back, and, last but not least, that Cairo simply be handed over to the Crusaders. Needless to say, Saladin was entirely unenthusiastic, replying that Jerusalem was as much a Muslim as a Christian place, even more sacred to us than it is to you, for it's the place from which our prophet made his ascent into heaven, and the place where we will gather on the day of judgment. Still, with his characteristic chivalry, he graced his response with expensive gifts, including 7 exotic camels and a luxurious tent, while Richard reciprocated with a beautiful horse. There was a meeting of Richard's chiefs late in the fall of 1191, where men probably shouted until they were hoarse about what they should do. The council told Richard outright that the army wanted to go to Jerusalem, despite his arguments about Ascalon. Lionheart accordingly set out toward the holy city, but the campaign foundered. The weather was turning miserably wintry. Rust and rot attacked supplies. Food was getting short for men and animals. There were constant Saracen attacks on the Crusader lines that stretched back to Jaffa. It had to be obvious to everyone that Richard's heart wasn't in it. This general, who was proven genius at getting an army where it needed to be, took 2 months to move 30 miles. By year end, he had set up a new headquarters some 20 miles short of Jerusalem, at a little dot on the road called Beit Nuba. To his men, being no more than a few days' march from their sacred destination was pure jubilation. Even with 1191 sagging into another winter of cold, wet hunger, soldiers were alive with anticipation. The only one who didn't share the general delight was Richard. But this bravest of soldiers, history's Lionheart, couldn't face a confrontation with his men. Instead, Richard did what his father so often did. He convened a council at the new year. He was careful with this one, packing it with royal supporters who predictably voted to pull back. "Yes," they nodded, "Jerusalem was too well defended. European supply lines too long. The weather too bad. The future too risky." Richard won their agreement that the army would leave Beit Nuba, moving south toward his constant goal, Ascalon, rather than east toward Jerusalem. His army was almost sick with disappointment at the news. Men sour-faced as they pulled on worn-out boots for yet another winter in this terrible land. they faced more marching. Marching that might take them anywhere except the only place they wanted to be. The only place they had agreed to fight for. The only place sworn to be the God-given mission of this entire crusade. This was God's war. Certainly not even Richard Lionheart, the glorious conqueror, could challenge God. Orders for the army to move south rather than east were thus incomprehensible to the rank and file, who knew they were only a few days' march from the walls of Jerusalem. Most of the French quit outright, some because of Richard, others because they were running out of money. Hundreds of irreplaceable knights left the ranks of the Crusader army. Conrad of Montferrat arrogantly held his own peace negotiations with Saladin. Crusaders who did stay began to fight with each other, over dry places to sleep, over debts, over food, over national pride. Men who were wet, cold, and hungry, with little prospect of getting dry, warm, and fed, fought for sheer lack of other ways to burn off their bad mood. Spies, a constant presence, made things worse by passing along reports that Saladin had been desperately weakened, not only by his recent failures in the field, but by rebellion in his own family. That information made the decision to abandon attack on Jerusalem look even more senseless. Soldiers' gloom at being deprived of their lives' ambition was crowned once they arrived in Ascalon, the once lovely city reduced to a freezing, soot-stained husk thanks to Saladin, who had burned it to the ground. The men glumly labored at the donkey work of manhandling stone to rebuild charred walls and towers, harried and prodded by Richard, who wanted to make the city the strongest fortress on the Mediterranean coast. For his soldiers, this was the grimmest of winters. At least the misery of the siege at Acre had had a point. Eventually, spring did come, of course, even in 1192. Sun and warmth and fragrant winds, new supplies, energetic new volunteers. Clothes could finally dry. All the endless drudge labor of the past months had finally produced some physical enhancements. Better places to sleep and eat, places to walk that were out of the mud, protection from the wind. Some French knights and archers wandered back to rejoin their comrades. Richard presided over Easter banquets. The ugly, depressing winter began to melt from conversation, if not memory. And then a powerful distraction arrived. An abbot named Robert of Hereford appeared in camp with reports from England. Robert's presence wasn't extraordinary. News moved between Europe and Syria with some regularity, including what we'd call newsletters about the crusade, written by Richard for the benefit of his key officials back home. But the abbot's news wasn't good. The domestic stability Richard had tried to ensure before he left England was drifting toward the rocks. The country simply wasn't the most reliable of royal platforms. For one thing, Richard, a very new king, had rarely spent time in that country. While men accepted him as the rightful heir to his prodigious father, he had left for crusade before forming a personal network of loyalists. On top of that, he was known across much of his empire for his insatiable hunger for money, combined with his often brutal insistence on dominance. His crusading fame won him a good deal of support, but he lacked the broad base of fidelity and trust that could carry his monarchy through bad times. And bad times had arrived. The senior tier of his government had imploded. Tough old William de Mandeville, Richard's chief in England, had died. The grandiose William de Longchamp, who'd fused the roles of justiciar, chancellor, bishop, and even papal legate in his own hands, triumphant Longchamp now faced down every other potential opponent, including William Marshall, who'd never been among Longchamp's friends. Holding so much power was enough itself to make Longchamp widely disliked, but he achieved a level of genuine detestation thanks to a haughty ego combined with flagrant nepotism, sneering dislike of the English, and very public flaunting of his very new wealth. How he came by that wealth did nothing to gain him friends. Charged with constantly refreshing Lionheart's coffers, in control of the crucial function of sealing legal documents, Longchamp siphoned off enough revenue to make himself very comfortable. The aristocratic Bishop of Coventry blasted the new chancellor for leaving nothing of value untouched in the kingdom. Not a man his belt, nor a lady her necklace. If Longchamp had at least been modest about his worldly gains, people might have swallowed it. But he wasn't modest, and his nouveau riche snobbery was the final irritant. His family had done well enough, true, but they were nobodies. Malicious gossip was quick to parody this male prima donna as nothing more than the grandson of a runaway serf. While it wasn't true, the popularity of the story was a good indicator of the public mood toward the man. There's a legend that clerks in his office even made a point of mocking his brother Osbert, a high sheriff thanks to the Chancellor's intervention, by drawing leering cartoons in the O of Osbert's name whenever the opportunity presented itself. The great Longchamp was apparently aware of his reputation. He mounted a PR campaign where minstrels were hired to walk London streets, crooning flattering songs about him. But it didn't do much good. Nor were problems with Longchamp the worst of Robert of Hereford's news. The worst involved John Lackland, the unruly younger brother who had been so handsomely bribed by Richard to stay out of England while Lionheart was away. Lackland was no longer a child. Furious at the news that his little nephew Arthur of Brittany had been named Richard's heir during the Sicilian campaign, John had reneged on his vow, returned to England, and set about undermining Richard the heroic crusader by public pronouncements, bolstered by widespread private fears that he'd never make it back alive. Prince John, at this early stage of his mad career, was smart, attractively groomed, affable, and open-handed. The many who couldn't stand grasping Richard and his taxes, much less Richard's man Longchamp, found a new rallying point in Richard's brother. Lackland soon had his own kingly court, complete with justiciar, chancellor, and personal army. His stronghold was arrogantly based in the very counties Richard had given him as payment for John's promise to stay on the other side of the channel. John's return to England proved an ugly problem for Longchamp. Before Lionheart had left the country, he'd given in to his mother's thinking that John should have the right to come across the channel, but had added a proviso that any return was dependent on Longchamp's approval. Apparently, it hadn't occurred to Richard that his brother might renege on his promise to stay away, even though Plantagenet brothers had a truly impressive record of stabbing each other in the back. Nor had Richard made the mental leap that a layman telling a royal prince where he could set his foot would not go well. John simply ignored both his pledge to his brother and his obligation to his brother's stand-in, since he never begged Longchamp's permission to enter the country. Longchamp, who had become the head of Richard's government, responded to this blatant affront to himself and to Richard by timidly doing nothing whatever. Men who watched all of this had to start calculating how to react, given that the king they barely knew was on a deadly adventure thousands of miles away. His younger brother was apparently getting stronger by the day, and the intensely unpopular Longchamp was impotent to do anything about it. One chronicler wrote anxiously, "Castles were strengthened, towns fortified, ditches dug." It was not a good time to be living your life in England. There was yet more bad news to pile on. Philip Augustus, home from the crusade, was suspiciously on the move, even more suspiciously making ingratiating contact with John. Roger of Hoveden, a seasoned English diplomat among his other many talents, attended the French court where he found Philip, quote, safe and sound and impudently announcing he was about to devastate the lands of the King of England. The French were even floating offers to marry the brutally rejected Princess Elise to John. Offers which rather ignored the fact that John was already married to the Gloucester heiress. Eleanor of Aquitaine herself had to threaten her unloved youngest son with the loss of every one of his rich holdings in England if he permitted himself a personal meeting with the French king. Richard, still embroiled in his unfinished war more than 2,000 miles from home, was now a very worried man. The predicament he faced in England left the greatest king in Western Europe sleepless and morose. Alternating between rash assaults on startled Muslim scouts and days of utter inertia when he sat staring at the floors of his tent. His actions over the next months would be confused and contradictory, as if this man, worshipped as the greatest of heroes, had suddenly lost his way. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again, January 27th, for the next episode of Lion's Forge. Available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.